7. This is now our eighth installment of chapter 7. I told you it was a rather lengthy chapter. Chapter 8 is also a rather lengthy chapter. And I am trusting that next week we can finish up chapter 7 and begin a new chapter in our journey. Chapter 7, as you can see on the board, deals with general rules of hermeneutics as related to prose. And we have four categories, four headings for that subject. And you can see on the board, Roman numeral 1, literary context. Each statement must be understood according to its natural meaning in its context. Roman numeral 2, historical cultural background. The correct interpretation of a Bible passage will be consistent with the historical cultural background of that passage. Roman numeral 3, we are discussing word meanings. That is what we will finish tonight. The correct interpretation of Scripture is the meaning required by the normal meaning of the words in the context in which they occur. So this is why we are looking at word meanings, because that's how we will find the interpretation. It will be there within those words and what they mean. We are at letter A, crucial issues about the nature of words. We discussed five of these. Words are arbitrary signs, meaning that they have a meaning that is assigned to them by the language group that uses those words. Number two, words have a range of meaning. Just as English, you pick up a word, and if I say the word fire, it has all kinds of meanings. There are a dozen or more meanings for that word. And so all words have a range of meanings. So do ancient Bible words. Number three, word meanings overlap. We have different words, can mean the same thing, or at least something close. We call them synonyms. So word meanings can overlap, although even though they overlap, you have to be careful that you don't use one word for another if in context they don't mean the same thing. Number four, word meanings change over time. Most of us here, if we have lived any time at all, know that there are words we use now that we wouldn't have used 30 years ago, at least with that specific meaning. And I could probably give a number of examples of that, but I think we understand what that means. Words change meaning over time. The number five, words have connotative and denotative meanings. In other words, there's a meaning that is the actual meaning of that word. I think the example we gave was a dog. But yet, if I call someone a dog, now that's a connotative meaning to that word dog. Now it's a term of derision. So words have connotative and denotative meanings. Last week, I think we looked at letter B, steps for performing, not last week, but the last time we were together, steps for performing word studies, and we have three of these. I believe we covered that first one last time we were together, and that is, what is the first step we would take in doing a word study? Well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to select words that require detailed analysis. Not every word in the passage requires an intensive, detailed analysis, right? We don't need to study every word in the passage. Not every word is equally complex. A lot of words are just plain, straightforward, and so we don't need to give them a lot of attention. We may give attention to some and then discover that, well, we really don't need to give that much attention to that word and move on to something else. We noted under number one here of selecting words that require detailed analysis, our writers of our textbook suggested six categories of words that would fit under that subheading. The first of these would be words that we don't understand in English, or possibly words that have theological significance. So when we come to passages of Scripture and we have the word atonement, we may want to give attention to that word. What does that word mean? If we come across the word justification or justify, the word right, righteous, righteousness, these are all words that have specific meaning theologically, and so we want to give attention to those words. Those words are important. Number two, we might want to give attention to what we call pivotal words or phrases. These would be specific verbs in that sentence or within that paragraph, maybe some participial phrases that might add meaning or turn the understanding of that text. We might give attention to specific adjectives, even prepositions. I believe that the last time we were together, I noted that there are some theological positions that are based pretty much on a specific preposition being used, or the lack of a preposition, or the lack of an article in a passage. People come up with different interpretations. So you're going to want to give attention maybe to some of those pivotal words. Thirdly, rare words that might be used only a few times. Or you may have a text where the word is used only once. Now that's going to be difficult, isn't it? Because it's used only once. So you might want to see if that word might be used in other literature outside the Bible to find out what that word means. So rare words. Number five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I only have... It's embarrassing. There's only five of them. I've been saying there's six all this time. Words that we don't understand in English, or pivotal theological words. Pivotal words, rare words. Number four, repeated words. You come to a text, if a writer uses a word several times, it probably has significance. So if a writer says this word over and over and over in a short amount of time, there's probably some significance there. So you may want to give attention to that. And then lastly, figures of speech. Specific metaphors, similes, personifications, maybe hyperbole. Maybe there was an irony in the statement. Maybe there's a euphemism being used. So you're going to want to give some attention to those metaphors or those similes. You're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. You're like sheep. The devil prowls like a lion. What is all that? What's the significance of that? My cup runs over, right? So those are metaphors and figures of speech we want to give attention to. And we want to be careful, because a lot of interpreters have taken the literal figuratively, and they have taken the figurative literally. And so we want to look at the context, find out what best suits the meaning of those words. So that is the first step for performing a word study, and that is selecting the words that you want to use. That brings us to number two, and we want to determine the range of meaning. We want to determine the range of meaning. It's here that the writers of our textbook give a good deal of attention to lexicons, and they spend a number of pages going over the various passages that are addressed in different lexicons. And what I thought I would do is hand this out to you. I'm sure you all can find your own lexicons, but these are just some suggestions written by the writers of our textbook for lexicons. So just give me a second to hand these out to you. Okay, thank you, and I'll leave the rest of those on the back for anyone else who may want a copy of that. This is very, very simple. It's just a list of some lexicons that were suggested by the writers of our textbook. I think I threw in a couple, the first two at the top, Thayer's and Vine's. I just threw those in because I think they're very helpful, they're useful, they're easy to read. Just about anyone can comprehend that material and grasp that material, so it's very accessible. You'll see the list at the top would be those lexicons that are not as complex as some others, and the ones at the bottom would be more complex. They would be more accessible to people who might have a better handle on some of the ancient languages, not necessarily a thorough knowledge of the ancient languages, but at least some acquaintance with those words, what they look like, how they're spelled, and some useful tools there for all of us to understand. A lexicon really simply is just a dictionary, and if I can say it as simple as possible. You can have a Greek lexicon, you can have a Hebrew lexicon, you could have a lexicon dealing with medical terms, medical lexicon. It's basically a dictionary, and for our intents and purposes, it's a dictionary in a different language, and specifically for us, it's a dictionary of ancient languages. And it's typically more detailed than an average dictionary. It'll have a lot of information. So these lexicons that I've handed out to you, any single one of them or all of them, if you want to pick one of those up, are invaluable to learning word meanings, and especially related to this subheading of determining the range of meaning. Because the lexicons will give you a long list of meanings, all the different meanings that the editors of that specific lexicon have chosen to include in the lexicon. So it'll have a number of those. You can go to them and you can just pull one up and it'll have just all kinds of them. Some of them, especially the ones at the bottom, may even have every time that word is used in the entire Bible. It will have an example of that in the lexicon, and then it will give you its place grammatically, whether it's a noun or a verb or an adverb. It will tell you what tense it is, what mood it's in. It will give you just all kinds of information related to those words. So lexicons are helpful if we're going to do a proper word study. They're almost a necessity for a proper word study to understand what's being said in that text. These lexicons that we have there, those volumes, will guide us as we understand words. And I have a list here of things that you can find. You'll find the root meaning of that word. How many times have we heard in sermons and in studies, in lessons, well, this is the word such and such, and this is the root meaning of that word, right? And so these lexicons help us find that root meaning. What is the bottom of that? It may be valuable, it may not. Another thing you can find is the etymology of that word. Where did it come from? Where did it start? How did it develop into what it means today? So the etymology of a word is good. That can be helpful. Sometimes it's not helpful, because the etymology of the word will tell you what that word meant 400 years ago when that language group first developed a meaning for that word. It may not mean the same now, but it is interesting to find the development of those words, and you can find the etymology of those words in your lexicons, right? You can get possible derivative meanings. In other words, the range of meanings in that word. Word use at the time that it was written. A lot of times those lexicons will say, well, this word meant something 400 years ago, but now as it's being used in the text in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, now it means this. And so those lexicons can help you find that information. How the word was used in non-biblical writings. A lot of times the lexicons will explain to you what that word means in the text, what it means in other places in the Bible, but also in extra-biblical material. What did it mean? They'll find letters that were written. They'll find documents. They'll find contracts that were written. They'll find legal documents. And they'll find those same words in those volumes outside the Bible. So it tells you what that word means outside. It means it's going to mean the same thing. It will mean the same thing. It's not something made up. We don't have a magic book that has words in it and we have to figure out what's really being said, right? I think I've said this 100 times. The idea, if you get on the phone and say, the package has been delivered. Repeat, the package has been delivered. Well, you know, that sounds like there's a code there, right? What's the package? Where's it going? Well, the Bible's not like that. It's not like that. You read what it says, and it means what it says. Exactly that. So it can tell you what words meant in non-biblical passages, how the word is used in other biblical passages. Should the word be taken literally or figuratively? A lot of times in those lexicons, it will describe for you that this word is used literally here, but over here it's used figuratively. So you'll have a passage about shepherds and sheep, literally having sheep, and then you'll see a passage that says, all we like sheep have gone astray. The word sheep there is being used how? Not literally, but figuratively. And that's important for us in our word studies. One last thing. What are some of the synonyms of that word? It will give you the word, and then it will list synonyms for that word. What other words could you use to explain that word? So we are determining the range of meaning. And remember, we said every word has a range of meaning. So you want to determine that. And if you're going to determine that, your lexicon is going to be one of your best friends, because it will give you all that information about those words. All right. It's not a perfect document. It's not inspired. But those lexicons are very, very helpful. That brings us down to number three here. We want to select the meaning that best fits the context. Forgot a T there. You want to select the meaning that best fits the context. Once you get a good understanding of the possible meanings for a word, then you must select the meaning that best fits the passage you're studying. Don't fall prey to the temptation of looking at a word and reading your lexicon and saying, oh, this is the coolest meaning I've seen, and then just add that to your passage. It may not mean that in the passage. It may mean that somewhere else. It may not mean that anywhere in the Bible. Maybe that's a meaning that was used in some extra-biblical literature. Select the meaning that best fits the context. You want to resist the urge to impose one of those possible meanings onto that specific passage that you are dealing with at the time. And we can be tempted to force a meaning onto a text simply because it better fits our theological position. So we can come up with where we see words and say, well, you know, that word could mean this. Well, that would really best fit my theology, but it might not be the intended meaning in that context. All right? So you want to be careful that you don't do that. You don't just sort of force a meaning on it. The writers of our textbook give us a couple of examples. One would be a position related to infant baptism. And we decided, depending on your position related to baptism, how are you going to interpret certain passages, specifically some of those passages in Acts that talk about households being baptized? You can look up the word household, and you can pull out your lexicon, find out what that word means. You can decide, you can see that it means not only the people in that home, like the father, the mother, and the children, but extended family, such as grandparents, maybe a cousin or two, also the servants of that individual who owns that home and their families, and it could include infants. And so you say, well, it could include infants, so that means that in this passage it must mean that infants were baptized. Now, that's not always the understanding of our paedo-baptist brothers. Some of them will readily admit that there's nothing in the book of Acts that talks about infants being baptized. Their position rests on a different thing, and that would be their understanding of the covenant relationship of those children. However, there are some who will take those texts and misapply a word because it best fits a theology. Mode of baptism is another one. How do you interpret those words? Baptism, the way that word is used. You look up the word baptizo in the Greek texts, in a lexicon, and it'll tell you that there are times when there are people who hold things underneath water to wash them, but it does not mean that it's something that is not completely immersed. Eschatology, your eschatological view. Some people will look at verses and say, well, this word can mean this, so then that must fit my position eschatologically. You want to resist the temptation to do that. Make sure that you're honest when you open the text, read the text contextually, what is the best meaning that fits that category? All right? I had this question, but I've already answered it for you. What is the most important factor in determining the most appropriate meaning? Class, what is the single most important factor in determining the appropriate meaning? Context. Say it with me. Context. That's it. contextual factors become the supreme arbiter for selecting the most probable meaning. The use of a word in a specific context constitutes the single most crucial criterion for the meaning of a word. Okay. All right, so that brings us to the end of this. Steps for performing word studies. You want to select the right words you're going to study. You're going to determine the range of meaning for that word, and then you are going to select the meaning that fits that context. Okay? All right, any thoughts or questions up to that point? Okay. I'm going to erase all of this. We'll go to Roman numeral 4, which will be the grammatical structural relationships, and we'll talk about some of that tonight. Grammatical structural relationships. It is true that the meaning of words is important. You've got to know the meaning of those words. That's important. But people don't communicate by just uttering single words. I suppose a poet could do that and take a poem and just write an entire poem just by single words. But that's not how we communicate. When we talk, we get together with our friends, we string together words, we make sentences, we make paragraphs, we pull together whole thoughts with words. So it's not just single words. So what's important also, not just the word meanings, but the grammatical structural relationships between those words in that context and in that sentence. We communicate, again, so this is what we want to give our attention to in the next few moments tonight, and then we'll wrap this up next week. We want to give our attention to the structure of these longer units, not just words, but phrases, clauses, sentences, paragraphs, groups of paragraphs, whole units within a book, and then an entire book. So we're looking at that grammatical structural relationship between those words. Grammar consists of two things: morphology and syntax. Two things. Morphology and syntax. Morphology, that just simply means how the words are constructed. Right? So if I have the word I have the word results. Right? I could write the word result. Right, that has a certain meaning. I could write the word resulted. That changes it, doesn't it? That's morphology. Morphology is simply those little pieces that we add onto our words in English. Right? We have less of those in English than a lot of other languages. A lot of other languages have specific endings or specific beginnings that make that word specific. It'll tell you which noun it's attached to. It'll tell you what verb it's attached to. In English, sometimes you have to guess a little bit. It's not always the same. Our verbs, you know, we have these irregular verbs and regular verbs. So that's just morphology. It's just simply the way the word is constructed. Go ahead and turn. Let's just have an example. Mark chapter 2. And I could go to any verse in the whole Bible, right? So there's just one here. Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2 and verse 1. All right. Mark chapter 2 and verse 1. It says, "And when he returned to Capernaum, after some days, it was reported that he was at home. So we have the word returned, and I have that little... So I have that little part of that word at the end, returned. What do we know about that? Now, what do we know now? We have here, and when he returned, right? So now we have a little clause here. When he returned, all right? It's telling us a time, when, so it gives us chronology, and you have returned, past tense. That's all that is. Morphology is just those little letters. That's all it is. In the ancient languages, they will tell you that if I say, you know, I see, you see, they see, we see, you know, in English, it's all see, right? Or, you know, I see a cat, you see a cat, all of you see a cat, right? Or I could say, she sees a cat, they see a cat, right? So the word see is different, but in the ancient languages, that morphology becomes important because it'll all be changed at the ending, and it kind of gives you exactly who's saying what. It's very helpful. That's all that is. Morphology is just the way those words are put together. The other one is syntax. All right, syntax. Syntax is just how the words are arranged in a sentence. All right, I have Mark chapter 2, verse 1. When he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. So after he returned to Capernaum, or what if I said, and when Capernaum returned to he? I've changed the meaning entirely in English, haven't I? Because the word order isn't right. That's the syntax. So morphology just has to do with the way the word is constructed. Each word is constructed. Syntax is how they're all put together in the sentence. Easy as that. And that's what we're looking at in grammar. We're looking at those two items. Morphology, how the words are constructed. Syntax, how the words are arranged in a sentence. Syntax is simply the way a language arranges words to form a meaningful phrase, sentence, paragraph. All right, so let's look at letter A, and that is the importance of grammatical relationships. And I'm just going to write the word importance. But we know that we're referring to the importance of grammatical relationships. Why is that important? Right? To understand, and now I'm quoting from our writers, to understand the meaning of any statement, we have to understand how words, phrases, sentences, and paragraphs are interrelated. That's the relationship that they have structurally. That's grammar. If you don't get the relationship between the words correct, you won't get the meaning of the sentence correct. All right? If you don't get the relationship between the words correct, you won't get the meaning of the sentence correct. If I say, John hit the ball, we all have now in our minds an image of what's taking place. What if I say, the ball hit John? Those are the exact same words, but they have been changed in order. The relationship now is different. So we have changed the meaning of the entire sentence. John hit the ball, or the ball hit John. That word order in English is extremely important for us as English readers. In Greek and in Hebrew, the word order is significant. However, it's not important for essential meaning. Many times you will have in some languages, you will have the verb will come first. Happy are you. Right, you may see that. Blessed is the man. Instead of the man is blessed. Maybe sounds a little better in English to say it that way. But we hear blessed is the man. All right, that does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly. So a lot of times you'll have that verb first and then the subject come after that. In English, not so much. A lot of times you'll have an adjective that will come after the noun. We see this a lot in some of the romantic languages. The example that came to my mind was in Spanish of Casa Bonita, right? It's a house beautiful. In English, what would we say? It's a beautiful house. So the word order is significant to the language speaker. But in English, in Hebrew and Greek, it is not essential for our understanding of the meaning of that text because of the morphology of those words, mainly. Now, let me give you another example. You're there in Mark 2. Look at Mark 1. Mark 1, and this is just an example of the literal word order. Mark 1 and verse 6. It says, "Now John was clothed with camel's hair and wore a leather belt around his waist and ate locusts and wild honey." That is the way that the translators of the ESV have chosen to put those words together for us to best communicate the meaning of that sentence from the original Greek text. If I were to read for you, and I will, the literal word order, here's what you would end up with. "And was John clothed in hair of camel and belt of leather around the waist of him, and he is eating locusts and honey wild." Okay. So the word order is different in the original language. It is significant. But in English, we would change that so that we could best understand it. All right? All right. I have one other example, but it may take a little bit of time, and I think we have about 1 minute left tonight. Any thoughts or comments or something we can try to help better explain in just the next few moments? Okay. All right. If not, then let's go ahead and take a moment to pray, and we will ask the Lord to bless what we have studied so far. Thank you, Father.